Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning to you, dear listener. It's Tuesday, the 19th of April. Welcome to Africa Link. I am Jane Ayeko Kumet in Bonn, Germany. In today's edition, South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar has failed once again to arrive in the capital, Juba.
So he said because of the process of how he is to get out from his headquarters, there was some logistical challenge.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has proposed three options for how to handle the escalating situation in Burundi.
Beyond early warning, beyond observing what's going on the ground, there is definitely a need for protection of civilians, given the fact that the police have been accused of perpetrating crimes against humanity, against the population.
We shall also be hearing about the fate of albino people in Senegal and issues to do with the environment in Mozambique. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Anxiety continues to surround South Sudan as the capital continues to await the arrival of rebel leader Riek Machar. He was expected in the capital Juba, where he is to be sworn in as vice president. This is part of an earlier peace deal with President Salva Kiir. William Ezekiel, who is the leader of Machar's team, attributed the delay to logistical reasons. Nevertheless, over 1,300 rebel troops and the rebels' second-in-command, Alfred Ladu, have already arrived in Juba. The people of South Sudan are hoping for the formation of a transitional government of national unity. Perhaps this would finally lead to restoration of peace in the country. Simon Woduwake in Juba reports.
There was some logistical challenging. He did not make it in detail, saying that, of course, Machar had to leave from his headquarters at the northern, in the northern part of the country. He has to fly, of course, via the airspace in Ethiopia before landing in Juba. Suddenly, just after journalists came to the airport, and like after an hour, again, there was another press briefing by Machar's spokesperson here in Juba. Anyway, this is the latest here. Machar did not come despite expectations by both citizens or nationals and also the government and Machar's advance team in Juba.
Okay. Well, just tell me, what is the latest development? What is the situation like at the moment?
Of course, Machar had to leave from his headquarters at the northern, in the northern part of the country. He has to fly, of course, via the airspace in Ethiopia before landing in Juba. So he said because of the process of how he is to get out from his headquarters, there was some logistical challenge.
It is not the first time his coming has been postponed. How can we be sure that he will actually arrive today?
Well, thank you again. You're right. Of course, this is not the first time that the coming of Machar has been postponed or cancelled. He was supposed to come in Juba last week, April 12th, but that was again cancelled for reasons he stated, that he did not finish arrangements or final arrangements with his leadership at his headquarters at the, in the northern part of the country. But whether he will come today, it is still, there is still no guarantee. But his officials did say that his coming today may be possible simply because the reasons as to why he failed to turn up Juba yesterday, they are all been sorted. Issues related to the logistic challenges, and of course, there is no any other pathway expected today as far as the arrangement for his coming is concerned, according to his officials yesterday while speaking to the journalists. So everybody, including the government and his advance team, or Machar's advance team in Juba here, is expecting his arrival today.
Simon Wake Wudu in Juba. In Ethiopia, the death toll of what is now referred to as the Gambele massacre has exceeded 200 people. South Sudanese men said to be from the Mule ethnic group are accused of carrying out attacks near the Ethiopian border with South Sudan. Ethiopian authorities have moved in to protect citizens. Raids in the area are not uncommon, but this is an unprecedented level of violence. Earlier on, I spoke to Ludger Shadomski, head of DW's Amharic service. He starts by telling us what we know about the attack and the attackers.
Well, the attackers are believed to be a subgroup of the Sudanese Mule ethnic group. They are known as violent cattle raiders. There have been similar attacks in the past in this region, but never really on the scale we saw this past weekend. And from what we understand from both the Ethiopian government and from eyewitnesses on the ground in Gambela, the attacks were directed against the Nuer. Now, the Nuer are one of the two major ethnic groups in southern Sudan, together with the Dinka. And the Nuer also live across the border inside Ethiopia. What is really now striking about this incident is that, the very scale of the attack has not happened within, I believe, some 12 years. All those years back, there were close to 200 people killed. So these attacks, they continue to occur. This time around, the attackers, according to eyewitnesses, were equipped with very modern Kalashnikov rifles. And what is still unclear is whether they were dressed in South Sudanese army uniforms.
From the sketch information that we have now, we were meant to understand it has something to do with the history of the people, like they are nomads. Something would say it's about cattle raiding or in search of pasture. But now, if we realize that it's actually people from South Sudan attacking fellow South Sudanese there, but carrying out the attack in Ethiopia, whereby some victims were actually Ethiopians, would you then say that this attack has a political significance?
I think it's too early still to talk politics at this point. But obviously now the expected arrival of Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar in Juba this week now raises some questions. And one question is, among the attackers are reported to be members of the Dinka ethnic group. Now, obviously, the Dinka and the Nuer are the two main rivals in South Sudan, and the South Sudanese president Salva Kiir himself is a Dinka. So if these reports were to be confirmed, I think then some serious questions would then present themselves. For now, I think it is really a mixture of resource-based conflicts, as we see a lot in that part of the world.
Even though we don't want to associate it to something that has a direct political significance as of now, at least we are not very certain of that. But couldn't this attack have political implications in terms of international relations between the two countries, I mean South Sudan and Ethiopia?
I'm not so sure. The Ethiopian government was at pains immediately on Friday to stress that this was by no means a political incident, but rather a cattle raid. The Mule were identified very early on as the attackers, and as I pointed out, they have been engaged in this kind of very aggressive cross-border raids into Ethiopia for a long, long time. They used to take cattle, also children. It has happened before, not on this scale. I think what remains to be seen now is how this will be now played by the two major parties inside southern Sudan, that is the Nuer and the Dinkas.
I was speaking to DW's head of Amharic service, Ludger Shadomski.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
And now to Burundi, where the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is proposing three options for a new UN police mission in the country. The first option would be a force of 3,000 to provide protection for the civilian population. The second would be a force of some 200 police officers. This would give early warning to further deterioration, but would not provide protection. The third option would be a group of 20 to 50 officers who would assess the Burundian police force and help encourage respect of human rights and rule of law. So, which of these options is best suited for a country embroiled in political instability and civil conflict? I put this question to Yolande Buka, a political and security analyst.
We are already a year through the crisis, and a significant number of people have passed away. Some people in the security sector, whether we're talking about the police or the military, have defected from the forces. So you definitely need a significant reinforcement. Second, I think beyond early warning, beyond observing what's going on the ground, there is definitely a need for protection of civilians, given the fact that the police have been accused of perpetrating crimes against humanity against the population.
If you recall, back in January, the African Union tried and failed to get a 5,000-strong peacekeeping force sent to Burundi. Bujumbura rejected this as an invasion of force. That's how they interpreted it. Can you then see the Burundian government shifting its position in any way?
I think the difference between the African Union and the Security Council is that the Security Council at this point has a lot more weight and a lot more leverage than the African Union Peace and Security Council. The Security Council could, under Chapter 7, deploy more robust forces, and it would be bounding by to the parties involved, including the Burundian government.
Now, considering how long the Burundian case has taken, would you say that the United Nations have the means and the necessary resolve to stop the bloodshed in the country?
I think the United Nations has the means, and there would definitely be contributing countries who would volunteer to deploy whether troops or, in this case, police officers. The question that you ask is about, that's most relevant to me, is the resolve. And I think there are some members of the Security Council that have the resolve to see at least the conditions necessary for the beginning of dialogue in Burundi. But at this point, some other members have decided to side with the Burundian government, who continues to argue that the situation is under control in Bujumbura and in the surrounding areas when it's not.
Now, talking about the situation not being under control, you remember that four members of the ruling party were killed on Sunday. Now, the pressure on the Security Council to act would appear to be growing by day. When can we expect a decision?
I think it's very difficult to tell. The lack of resolve from the international community has a bit shifted the momentum.
I was speaking to Yolande Buka, a political and security analyst.
Africa on the move.
Seclusion, unemployment, homelessness and skin cancer are just some of the struggles people with albinism face. In Senegal, the National Albino Association has made a call for action. They want a sunscreen factory to be built in the country. This would make it easier for albinos who badly need sunscreen creams to protect their skin. It would also create jobs and contribute to reducing unemployment. The local production of this much-needed product would make it cheaper for many to afford. Senegal has a population of more than 10,000 albinos. From Senegal, Emmanuel Landis reports.
I'm in Guédiawaye in the Greater Dakar suburbs visiting one of Senegal's albino families. Amadou Diallo and his wife have five children. Four of them live with albinism. Mahamadou, at 13 years old, is the eldest. He tells me the challenges he faces at school as an albino.
They are kind, but sometimes they can be difficult. I told them I'm albino, but I'm like you. An albino is someone that has a skin problem, and it's the will of God. At school, sometimes I can't read the writing on the blackboard.
Mahamadou's father, Amadou, says his children don't face the stigma seen in other African countries, but due to the medical needs his children require, it's not easy raising albino children.
The condition for the kids at school are hard. His work is not as good because he can't handle everything at the same time, because he has eyesight problems. Conditions are hard for them at school.
Albinos here may not be victim to violent attacks, as seen in many parts of Africa, but their struggle is just as tough. Often living on the street, exposed to harsh sunlight, they develop skin cancer, but with no access to medical attention, mostly go undiagnosed or untreated. Mahamadou Bamba Diop, president of the National Albino Association, is calling on the government to help set up a sunscreen factory to improve their health.
At this time, the real need is the sunscreen factory and also activities to help people with albinism to leave the street, because most of them are living with HIV/AIDS. They cannot have access to medication. Most of them are living with skin cancer. Most of them are dying. To stop all these things, we need to put in place this fabric of sun cream. That's why today we raise our voice to say that This has to stop. Discrimination has to stop. We are excluded. Today, we are asking for our right.
Currently, Senegal has over 10,000 people living with albinism. Diop says the dermatologists in the country lack the expertise to treat albino skin. Nevertheless, the National Albino Association has a volunteer medical expert they can refer members to. Dr. Tabitha Kivit, a Dutch national, gives free skin checkups but also sensitizes people on albinism.
In Senegal, the dermatologists are not specialized for skin cancer. They are also not specialized for albinism, skills. The problem right now, if you are a person living with albinism and you go to the hospital with your skin cancer, you cannot have access to the dermatologist because they don't know anything about albinism.
The Senegalese government classifies albinos as disabled people and it's placed them under the ministry which takes care of women, family and children. However, it has no budget allocated to help albino families with their everyday or medical needs.
Emmanuel Lander. Now, compared to other European countries, Germany is still lagging behind in investing in Africa. Currently, Africa only counts for 2% of German foreign trade compared to Turkey, which is Germany's top trading country with 8.7%. But with Africa's continuous economic growth and increasing population, German companies are hoping to reverse the trend. Jen Nyingi reports.
For a very long time, Africa was associated with war, poverty and disease. But now it's a continent on the rise. While many German investors have been reluctant to join this scramble to do business with Africa, there are a few who've taken the leap. B. Braun Melsungen, a medical and pharmaceutical company, has been operating in Africa for the last 25 years. Its annual sales in Africa are worth 100 million euros. CEO Heinz Walter Grosse says the company is hoping to expand further.
If we want to increase our business in Africa, we also have to establish more manufacturing units. We have to bring work to Africa. Right now we are evaluating how to establish such a manufacturing unit in Kenya.
Grosse says African leaders can help by creating a more conducive business environment.
In Africa, it's the really well-known issues of infrastructure, of energy, but also, of course, always the question of corruption. And we as a German company, as a privately owned company, we basically have a zero tolerance there. And if you are very strict in dealing like this, it might be sometimes not that easy, but I think it is accepted and you can be also very successful.
One African country increasing its trade with Germany is Kenya. Around 85 German companies are investing in the nation. But there is still a huge trade imbalance between the two countries. German exports to Kenya amount to 422 million euros, whereas Kenya's export to Germany are worth less than a quarter of that. Germany's main export to Kenya are solar and wind technology, machinery, chemicals, pharmaceutical products and motor vehicles, with Kenya exporting to Germany flowers, tea, coffee and vegetables. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta recently embarked on a drive to woo German investors.
Kenya is an economy that does not depend on extractive industries. We are an agricultural-based economy that is very, very strong in services as well.
One of those entrepreneurial Kenyans is Chris Kirubi, a leading industrialist.
We buy a lot of products from Germany, and therefore we would like some of these things relocated in Kenya. I am in partnership with DHL, which is part of Deutsche Post. I'm also in partnership with the biochemicals, and therefore I think there is room for Germans to come and invest in Kenya.
That's the next step for German-Kenyan trade. Currently, Germany mainly uses Kenya as a traditional raw material exporter, but Kenyan investors are pushing for a more equal partnership that would enable both economies to grow.
Jen Nyingi with that report.
Making a difference.
As in many African countries, pollution has become a major issue in Mozambique. The impact of inadequate trash disposal is especially visible along the coast. Here, all kinds of waste can be found in large amounts, much of it just left behind by visitors. Environmentalist and legal expert Carlos Serra Jr. decided something had to be done. This report by Christiane Viere was adapted for Africa Link and is now presented by Labde Wright.
All kinds of waste is scattered along Miramar Beach in Maputo, Mozambique's capital. A group of 26 activists spend their Saturday collecting the garbage. Starting last year, the group has removed garbage from four provinces in 15 cleaning operations like this one. The man behind the cleanup operation is environmentalist Carlos Serra Jr. He uses social networks to mobilise Mozambicans.
When we first announced on Facebook and other social networks that we were going to do a clean-up, nobody cared. But now we've already done 15. And when we announce it now, people say, look, these people don't stop. So I'm also going to think twice before I throw my trash away.
Carlos Serra Jr. heads the legal team responsible for environmental policies and legislation at the Mozambican Ministry of Land, Environment and Rural Development.
It is a matter of putting the government machinery into motion, and it works. It's much easier for an institution like this ministry to approach other public and private institutions or civil society organizations and mobilize them for the common cause.
The beauty of the country's coast is obscured by waste on the beaches where there are no trash cans to be found. 25-year-old Mauro de Brito searches for tiny pieces of glass hidden among the grains of sand.
Well, I would like to leave it really clean. I will do as much as I can. What I cannot do is do nothing, not collect this glass. I can at least make some small improvement.
Around 15 kilometers away from Miramar Beach, the mangroves, which act as natural filters, are also clogged up with trash. Activist and law student Leopoldina Gouveia says this has led to a radical change in her life.
It was an instinct. I can't eat fish anymore, I just can't. I haven't got the courage, because to eat fish is to eat trash. The animals eat the waste we throw away.
Back at the ministry, Carlos Serra Jr. wants to change society's mentality in Mozambique concerning the way people deal with waste. He wants people to understand the value of nature and admire its beauty, as he does.
It's important to contribute to a process of change, to help people stop doing things the same old way, to show that doing nothing is very wrong.
By the looks of it, he has his work cut out for him. On Miramar Beach, a couple of young people are enjoying the last rays of sun. As they move on, they leave their empty beer bottles and soft drink cans on the sand, just a couple of feet away from the sea. It will certainly take some time for environmental awareness to become routine in Mozambique.
Loved it right with that report. Now that brings us to the end of the program. But remember, we welcome your opinion on this program. Do send us your comment to +49 160 957 59510 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Before we wind up, here is a reminder of our top stories. South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar is yet to arrive in South Sudanese capital Juba to form a government of national unity. And in Burundi, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has proposed three options for how to handle the escalating situation in the country. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. I'm Jen Ayeko-Kumet. Enjoy the rest of your day.